Disinfection is a familiar concept in modern life. Advertising slogans for popular disinfectants appeal to profound cultural fears about contamination, promising that their preparations can kill 99.9% of bacteria and prevent the spread of dangerous germs. But where did this concept originate? Did disinfection take shape alongside the germ theory that now legitimises it? In many ways, the desire to keep things clean and wariness of potential disease seemed nothing but common sense. But the extent to which such ideas can be regarded as obvious in the context of Victorian knowledge about disease causation is nevertheless a complicated issue and one which requires careful consideration. Despite the apparent historical and historiographical ubiquity of reference to disinfection, the methods of and rationale behind these policies have rarely been explored in detail. I explored the various changes in disinfection policy by looking at a range of published popular and professional texts on disinfection and health, published medical, public health and chemical journals, adverts, local authority minutes and reports, and newspapers and company records. These provided an insight into the various aspects of disinfection policy. I'm only going to present on one aspect of this today, but as I said, I'm happy to discuss the wider project. This paper explores the evolution of disinfection policy in five case study Lancashire towns, identifying the chronology and nature of policy change in the context of national legislation, developments in scientific knowledge, and medical debates. The five case studies I looked at were Bolton, Preston, St Helens, Manchester, and Liverpool, as these provided examples of urban areas of different sizes, political inclinations, and occupational structures. Using these case studies, I will show that although germ theory and national legislation prompted increasing disinfection efforts at local level, this diverged significantly from national narratives of best practice, increasing the gap between theory and practice. It is important to set the context in which local authorities were operating. So the first section of my paper sets out the links between germ theory and changing definitions of disinfection, looks at how capacity for practical disinfection changed over time, and the legislative context in which authorities operated. The advent of germ theory in the period from 1870 onwards changed the understanding of disease causation. This has been the subject of very wide historiographical attention, and I can't go into any real detail here, but I just wanted to highlight a couple of key points. Warboys has pointed to the more diffuse and nebulous impacts of germ theory on public health as compared to medicine or surgery, but also that germ theory was used in a variety of ways to shape both inclusive and exclusive interventions. In a particular case of disinfection, this meant a narrowing of the focus away from issues of wider environmental cleansing and reorientation towards a specific emphasis on killing germs. And this had a profound effect in changing theories of disinfection. Definitions of disinfection had initially taken a pluralist approach to their purpose and action within a germ context. For example, in 1873, Edward Smith claimed that disinfectants should destroy protoplasmic and germ life. Nevertheless, in discussing the shortcomings of some disinfectants, he also mentioned that they failed because they allowed germs to develop, indicating that he also included inhibiting germs within the process of disinfection. The removal of bad smells could also be seen as a disinfection process in some situations. The 1880s and 1890s saw an increasing shift in both professional and popular advice books to a more focused approach to killing germs, so that germicide and disinfection effectively became synonymous terms. This is made most obvious by examining handbooks of hygiene, which often ran through multiple editions over several decades and can be used to trace changing views. In the 7th edition of his Handbook of Hygiene, published in 1892, George Wilson defined disinfection as killing contagion, which he then specified was germs or bacteria. This completed his shift from espousing antiseptic, deodorant and fixative aspects of disinfection in 1873 to seeing disinfectants solely as germicides. By 1900, Samuel Riddell, world expert, famous chemist, and author of a very influential monograph on disinfection, was confident that the debate was completely settled. Disinfection meant killing germs. This ignored, however, that there was ongoing dissent in some quarters, particularly in popular advice texts. Definitions of disinfection in the second half of the century thus increasingly concentrated on equating disinfection with germicide, excluding all other functions and branding them distracting or dangerous to proper disinfection. Alongside this, other disease prevention practices were defined and specified so that antisepsis and deodorization could be clearly delimited alongside disinfection. This strengthened the definitional status of all three processes, but imposed a hierarchy on them. Building on this, disinfection as germicide grew in perceived importance in this period, with authors increasingly seeing it as a necessary part of any disease prevention campaign. In this way, it seems that germ theory had brought new clarity to disinfection practice and overhauled the entire subject, giving a clear, certain, and exclusive category of action based in scientific reason. This straightforward narrative nevertheless conceals some of the tensions associated with these changes. Authors of both professional and popular texts continue to include other methods apart from killing germs within disinfection, giving a wider definition of disinfection practices. And whilst these criticisms decreased in number and strength as time progressed, they highlight that germicide was not necessarily the only conclusion that could be arrived at for disinfection in a germ era. Incorporating new germ ideas into the practical demands of disinfection could be problematic and varied according to the differing responsibilities of various parties. The equation of disinfection with germicide was widespread but unstable, leaving room for interpretation and debate. These changes in the understanding of disease transmission and prevention helped also to change the legislative landscape on health, albeit slowly. The late 19th century saw widespread expansion of legislation on public health, covering all manner of topics from the provision of water and gas to housing, notification of infectious disease, and other matters. These powers came from both national and local acts, leading to a patchwork of varying provision. Disinfection did not, however, fit the pattern identified by Christopher Hamlin, whereby national legislation was relatively unimportant in the development of authorities' powers. Local acts did not usually include any provisions for disinfection. Unusually, it was general legislation that gave authorities the ability to act if they required it. The same powers were available to all areas if they chose to use them. National legislation increasingly included disinfection powers, reflecting the growing interest in allowing and then mandating local authorities to undertake disinfection. The 1866 Sanitary Act set up the first general powers to disinfect houses and items. If a certificate issued by a medical practitioner said that cleansing or disinfecting any house or part thereof or any article therein liable to retain infection would tend to prevent or check infectious or contagious disease, the nuisance authority had to give notice in writing, requiring the owner or occupier to undertake cleansing and disinfection. If they failed to comply, they would be fined. The authority could also disinfect the property themselves and claim the cost back from the owner. These powers were expanded by the 1875 Public Health Act and the 1890 Infectious Diseases Act. The 1875 Act shifted the emphasis by adding in a role for the Medical Officer of Health. He was to decide which properties needed to be disinfected. The 1890 Act then added new locations for disinfection, in particular schools and public transport, extending the remit of policy. Of equal importance was the increasing shift towards local authority control of disinfection processes. The 1890 Act strengthened authorities' hand. It was presumed that they would disinfect. The householder could only do so if they responded within 24 hours and performed the task to a standard acceptable to the medical officer of health. Legislation thus made authorities, rather than householders, increasingly responsible for undertaking disinfection of houses and objects. The development of legislation shows that power was increasingly vested with local authorities rather than with the public. This recognised the increasingly specific and scientific underpinnings of disinfection and the suspicion of the ability of the public to undertake this effectively. In this way, legislation became more, not less, authoritarian, in contrast to the developments in other areas of policy, such as vaccination. The continuing focus on environments as well as people is also clear, and this is contrary to ideas about the increasing exclusivity of policy, revealing the difference between disinfection and other policies. The third feature in this changing landscape of disinfection understanding was developments in disinfection methods and processes. Processes remained stable throughout the period. A case of endemic or epidemic disease, the list broadly corresponded with the category zymotic, necessitated that the patient be isolated in hospital or in one room of the house, that their textiles, personal items, and anything they touched be disinfected, usually by heat, in order to ensure infection did not break out elsewhere in the community, and then at the end of the illness, the room had to be disinfected to draw a line under the outbreak and make the house safe again. Disinfection methods are rather complicated, and it's not possible for me to give you more than a sort of brief overview within the scope of this paper, but I'm going to try and give you some idea. At the start of the period, there were several things which could be used to disinfect. These were principally chemicals, like zinc chloride solution, gases for fumigation, like sulfur and chlorine, and physical approaches, mostly dry heat, which were applied to textiles. The development of the chemical industry from the 1850s meant that more compounds could be manufactured, and this provided people with an increasingly wide range of chemical substances that could be used as disinfectants. Indeed, there seems to have been something of a tendency to try and see whether any chemical could act as a disinfectant. There were also increasing options for heat disinfection apparatus. So this is street disinfection in Liverpool. Just find it. And this is an example of a heat disinfection apparatus from Liverpool in the 1890s. It's a steam disinfection machine. The idea is you would put the clothes in this end, shut the machine up, leave it to work for a few hours, and then get them out the other side. So alongside this development in local authority disinfection, there was a widening of options in terms of marketing of commercial disinfectant products, including Izol, Sanitas, and Jays, which were aimed at the popular mass market. The options became far wider as the century progressed, which necessitated means of differentiation. Alongside this, there were significant developments of testing methods. Disinfectants were initially assessed based on whether they prevented recurrence of disease or if they halted the process of putrefaction. These were all essentially proxy methods that did not get precisely at the action of disinfectants on contagion. Germ theory, however, provided a way to assess the action of disinfectants directly on disease-causing agents. This, coupled with changes in how disinfection was defined, meant that by 1900, testing the effectiveness of disinfectants was done by testing on germs in a laboratory. Researchers assumed that this was the best way to test disinfectants, although this could be troublesome. Settling on a standard method that both replicated conditions disinfectants faced in practice, so this kind of environment, but which also gave a high degree of reliability and test-retest consistency and scientific rigour, was nigh on impossible. Researchers eventually settled on scientific rigour, which, as I'm going to talk about later, was sometimes problematic. This new research led to some post-germ theory shifts in which methods were regarded as most effective and therefore most preferable. sulfur fumigation became regarded with suspicion, as it did not kill germs in the laboratory. Carbolic acid's reputation as the premier disinfectant was undermined, and mercury perchloride became far more highly regarded. The main themes of disinfection nevertheless remain the same throughout the period from 1866 to 1914. This can best be illustrated with reference to two advice texts, one from 1866 and one from 1903. They both agreed that disinfection was important, that the patient and the sick room were the focus of the work. They both advocated disinfecting clothes, bedding and excreta by heat and by chemicals. They agreed on isolating the patient and the disinfection of the room by some form of chemical gas at the end of the illness. In this way, overall continuity was maintained, demonstrating the extent to which germ theory only touched the extremities rather than the heart of disinfectant practice. The sheer range of choices and the debate surrounding them nevertheless made choosing a disinfectant far more taxing and fraught as time progressed. Local medical officers of health therefore faced a world in which they had increasing responsibility, new knowledge, and a wider range of means at their disposal, but which required them to make more extensive decisions about how they proceeded. So, how did local policy develop? As we have seen, local powers for disinfection of objects were introduced in 1866. The Public Health Acts also mandated that authorities undertook disinfection of items, houses, and provided general disinfection advice. Identifying how local authorities responded to these changes in legislation is important. Their reactions varied greatly. Lucinda Beyer has claimed that disinfection was applied to an increasingly wide range of ailments beginning in the 1880s. F.B. Smith has made similar statements, stating that disinfection became even more terrible after the 1880s. On the contrary, the local areas that I studied showed that disinfection was being undertaken before 1866, although this varied between the localities. Epidemic sickness was a prompt to disinfection in a number of areas. In Preston, in 1832, with the approach of cholera threatening the town, several means of prevention, including whitewashing, disinfection, and street washing, were considered. Non-epidemic disinfection was less common, but existed in some areas, including Bolton, Manchester, and Liverpool. Only one of my case studies, St. Helens, showed no evidence of disinfection. It seems that the smaller towns with less developed structures may not have had the capacity to pursue these policies before the 1870s. But the disinfection of houses and dwellings was therefore well established by the 1860s, and disinfection was emphatically not adopted solely as a result of germ theory, but was a pre-existing practice in many urban locations. Routine systematic disinfection became far more common by the 1870s. Most of the case studies had established a common pattern of disinfection by 1874, including fumigating houses, disinfecting items, distributing disinfectants and giving out advice, and specialist policies such as the disinfection of infectious dead bodies. The appointment of medical officers of health in the medium-sized and smaller towns I studied seems to have been a key influence in the more organised and widespread nature of disinfection practice. Indeed, in St. Helens, the smallest and least institutionally developed case study, action only really started after 1874 when Dr. Robert McNichol was appointed MOH. He set about establishing the usual system of disinfection, showing how far it had become standard by that time. The overall approach to disinfection at local level was thus set in the 1870s, demonstrating that the advent of organised public health allowed an expansion of existing disinfection programmes into routine practice, but not any absolute innovation in approach. So, how far was disinfection the common or standard response to endemic disease? All but one of the five localities showed an increase in the number of rooms and houses disinfected between 1870 and 1914, and had similar patterns for the number of items disinfected, although the exact chronology differs. The evidence points to the fact that disinfection was reaching an increasing proportion of the population, including those further up the social scale. The wider reach of disinfection, legitimised by germ theory and mandated by legislation, does seem to have occurred at local level. The chronology does not support a major break with germ theory, but an intensification of policy. But did this also result in the types of methodological change disinfection researchers demanded? So, how did the disinfection methods used change over time? There was remarkably little change in method or policy, despite widespread concerns about the effectiveness of common methods. Disinfection approaches can be broken down into three main areas: disinfection to treat rooms and houses, disinfection to treat clothing, and those to generally cleanse objects. I'm going to use disinfection of rooms and houses as an example of the complexities of how local practice did and did not change over time. As well as the ongoing disinfection of objects while the patient was recovering, a room needed to be disinfected at the end of the illness in order to prevent recurrence of the infection. Most commentators agreed that the best way to do this was by fumigation, and references to the process appeared in all advice texts throughout the century. Fumigation entailed a series of processes. Firstly, the room was emptied of all furniture, textiles, and any items which might be damaged. The walls and the ceiling were washed, stripped of any paper, and then the windows and doors of the room were pasted shut. The apparatus was then set up. For sulphur, this meant setting sulphur on fire, normally by placing the chemical in a metal bucket, which was then placed in a big bucket of water so not to set the house on fire. If they were using chlorine, two chemicals were combined and left to react. The operator then made a swift exit, lest he be overcome by the fumes. There were several cases of disinfectors being killed by staying too long in the room after they'd set the apparatus up. They then pasted at the door, left the chemical to act for a minimum of several hours, preferably overnight. Essentially, this was a very roundabout way of treating a surface with a chemical agent. It was thought that the sulphur or chlorine compounds would settle on the surface of the room and thereby kill any germs present. Afterwards, the room was aired out for 1 or 2 days, the surfaces were again washed, any remaining wallpaper stripped, and the walls and ceiling lime washed. For the most part, this process was undertaken by sulphur or chlorine. The germicidal effectiveness of both substances was, however, increasingly questioned through the latter half of the 19th century. Sulphur came in for the most criticism, with the backlash beginning from the 1870s. The substance was so poorly regarded that by 1900, the Lancet claims that sulphur fumigation was little better than a rite or an incantation. Some were unconvinced that sulphur was ineffective, pointing to positive practical experimental results, which they said demonstrated its efficacy. More importantly, sulphur remained the agent most generally recommended by popular advice texts until 1910. So it was often accepted that this was the method that would be used by local authorities, and it was recommended by some medical professionals and by the British government. Sulphur was indeed the most commonly used method in the case studies I looked at. Liverpool undertook the process from the 1870s, with Bolton, Preston and St Helens following suit in the 1870s. And this continued until the end of the period I studied, and actually into the 1920s and 1930s in some areas. The continuing use of sulphur fumigation, long after the method had been discredited, is of particular interest, and demonstrates the extent to which actual practice lagged behind what was seen as best scientific advice. Several of the areas showed increasing realisation that sulphur was regarded as ineffective. St Helens provides a useful example of this. Some doubt as to the efficacy of sulphur in dealing with diseases such as scarlet fever had been expressed in the 1880s on account of a string of repeat cases in houses that had been suspected, had meant to be disinfected. By 1893, this doubt was more explicit, as the Medical Officer of Health claimed that houses were fumigated preparatory to a general cleansing down and lime washing. The relative importance of the different aspects of the process was clearly shifting. Indeed, the Medical Officer of Health was well aware of the research which identified potential problems of sulphur disinfection, claimed it was dubious, and attributed St Helens' success in preventing illness, in particular the tenacious infection of scarlet fever, to the use of steam disinfection of textiles through this sort of machine, and post-fumigation processes like washing of walls. The ability of post-processes to make sulphur effective was important and highlights the general shift away from confidence in sulphur disinfection in of itself. Despite this, the process continued to be used in the 1920s in some areas, demonstrating the tenacity of familiar practices where disinfection was concerned. This rested on the apparent effectiveness of the method in preventing repeat cases. Even the sceptical St Helens Medical Officer of Health boasted about the low failure rate of his disinfection policy for scarlet fever, which was thought to be the most resistant and most difficult to treat infection. And although he attributed this to the entire process of fumigation, rather than just sulphur itself, he made little effort to change the policy. It was this difference between the lab research, which considered the chemical in isolation, and the experience of medical officers of health, who looked at how it worked out in practice, that made the difference to how they approached their policy. The evidence therefore illustrates the conservative approach of local medical officers of health, even where they were aware of new research on the drawbacks of the methods they used. Correspondingly, change to new methods was slow. The biggest innovation was the development of ways to apply liquid disinfectant directly to a wall or a ceiling. This was done by adapting sprayers which were used to apply pesticide to apple trees, amongst other methods, and changed the approach in that the operator took a hose, filled the container with the chemical, and sprayed down every surface in the room. This had the added advantage that if it was done correctly and with some skill, it didn't damage wallpaper, so removed a lot of the extraneous processes and presumably a lot of the annoyance to the person whose house was being treated. Various chemicals were used for spraying, but the most commonly recommended was formaldehyde or formalin, which emerged in the 1890s as an alternative to the messy and apparently ineffective sulphur method. Formaldehyde was extremely widely debated, critiqued, and tested. Its drawbacks were highlighted. It was ineffective in the presence of organic matter, which, given that disinfectants were often expected to act on substances where there was a lot of organic matter, in particular feces, urine, discharges, this was quite a problem. But eventually, research concluded that provided certain situational conditions were met, in particular ensuring there was an excess of the chemical acidifying the substance and other more kind of practical approaches, formalin spraying could be an effective alternative to the apparently ineffective sulphur method. It then began to appear in professional advice texts as a recommended method and became adopted as end of illness room disinfection. Some areas adopted these new methods, but generally only on a small scale. Liverpool was the exception. They moved to using formalin for 75% of all the rooms they disinfected by 1906, and by 1913 it was the only approach used in St Helens. Preston started to use formalin in 1911, but only on a limited scale, with only 19 houses being treated in this way in the first year. While some areas were clearly interested in experimenting with new methods and adopted new approaches relatively quickly, the overall process of innovation was comparatively slow, and they were more likely to stick to tried and tested methods that were believed to work tolerably well in practice and commanded the assent of the population. Whilst not everyone might have liked sulphur fumigation, it was exceedingly familiar. In fact, similar processes appear in the Bible, so local populations knew what this would entail. The lack of a sensible alternative to fumigation left authorities in a quandary. Abandoning the method would undermine the overall process and approach to disinfection, but before 1900, there was nothing substantially superior to substitute in its place. The reasonable response was therefore to continue using older methods, even though they were known to be imperfect. The sulphur and chlorine were both increasingly discredited, but continued to be used. This could be explained by inertia or a rejection of new germ research, but this did not, however, account for why the relatively informed medical officers of health acted in this way. Statements about the effectiveness of fumigation reveal that whilst medical officers of health engaged with new research, they were concerned with a wider range of factors than simple germicidal effectiveness when devising their policy. Whilst fumigation was not ideal, they found it worked sufficiently well to curtail the spread of disease in their towns, and they and their staff were familiar with it, how to do it well, and the demands it placed on their staffing and their resources. Fumigation also had a strong cultural heritage, which made it the obvious option when deciding to disinfect a room. Until other methods could meet these socio-cultural criteria, there was no reason to switch to them. This highlights the continuity of practice over the second half of the century, showing that whilst germ theory changed the concept of disinfection, it was not always able to change the practice. This goes against assumptions that germ theory was instrumental in advancing more developed forms of practical disinfection, and local practice was far more about continuity than change. As we have seen, fumigation policies remained remarkably stable over time, despite changes in disinfection theory and method. Did this reflect a lack of engagement with germ theory and disinfection research at local level? I would argue that this was not the case. There is clear evidence that at least some of the case study areas were considering their policy in terms of germs. As we have seen, most areas started a disinfection policy before germ theory was fully articulated or developed, showing that the older ideas of disinfection were influential in prompting the adoption of a policy. Medical officers of health blended old and new ideas throughout the period, linking contagion and disease-causing particles to germs. For instance, in 1879, Dr. Sargent discussed disinfection. He was medical officer of health of Bolton, he claimed that disinfection would remove the contagious particles of disease. These were particulate and dangerous, sharing many of the characteristics of germs. By the mid-1880s, he was more convinced of the need to kill germs, but had not adapted his policy. Similar statements were expressed in the other case studies during the 1870s and 1880s, and as time progressed, the focus on germs increased. Manchester in particular was very well informed. The medical officer of health, Mr. Lee, reported on various issues, and which showed that he was familiar with Pasteur, Liebig and other authors, and he explicitly linked his practice from the 1880s onwards to the need to destroy germs. Dr. Tatham, his successor, commissioned his own research on a number of topics from Sheridan Delapine, a well-known bacteriologist based at Owens College in the city, as a way to assess the germicidal effectiveness of the disinfectants he had chosen and the policy he had put into place. Manchester was the most innovative area in many ways, experimenting with new policies and showing a much greater interest in research. There was also, as discussed above, recognition that germ-based research did not necessarily provide the knowledge that medical officers of health needed, so Manchester was unusual in doing this. Local areas were extremely conservative in the methods they applied, using outdated techniques long after credible alternatives had been accepted by professionals. they preferred those which had proved effective and were deemed practical, and were only prepared to adapt to new methods where they fulfilled all the criteria they demanded. Since the concerns of medical officers of health were grounded in making disinfection policies simple to implement, there was a complicated relationship between theoretical best practice and the realities of disinfection on the ground. Despite the changing science and definitions of disinfection, practice remained mainly the same in these five localities during the second half of the century. Germ theory, whilst able to prompt some change, was unable to unseat the existing approach as the legislative assumptions about medical officers of health and their approach did not line up with their opinions. The various strands of disinfection history combined to reveal the complex and ambiguous underpinnings of public health at local level. Germ theory overhauled concepts of disinfection and increasingly influenced the recommended practices. It also created a new structure by which disinfectants were tested, and a new faith in the ability to undertake reliable, scientific disinfection. This confidence in professional authority was paralleled by a lack of faith in public disinfection, based both on people's presumed ignorance and their assumed tendency to be led astray by commercial interest and poor advice. The irony was that this proliferation of commercial interest and advice had itself resulted from germ theory. Attempts were made to counter this by education, information, and coercion, but these were only a partial measure. The above advances underlined the necessity of entrusting disinfection to the professionals and the importance of the professions as a primary driver for disinfection advice. For this reason, medical officers of health sought and were given by national legislation more power to direct and undertake disinfection, and the rights of the public, as enshrined in the rights of the householder, receded. The effectiveness of disinfection had thus been safeguarded. This did not, however, result in the improvements that might have been supposed. Whilst germ theory resulted in some changes in practice, practical factors meant that not all types of advice were changed by it, fumigation being a key area where change was slow. This linked to the problems of applying germ theory to disinfectant testing. Whilst theory changed the terms on which disinfectants were tested, researchers found it difficult to distinguish between promoting the search for scientific truth and attempting to guide practice, and had not come to a satisfactory conclusion by 1914. This lack of clarity in research and practical obstacles affecting methods meant that the research agenda increasingly did not meet the needs of local medical officers of health, who continued to favour older practices. The new germ-informed practice, which legitimised their power and characterised their professional authority, had only limited impact in practice. There was a tension at the heart of disinfection that illustrates an eternal problem in public health practice, in reconciling the implications of scientific analysis with public opinion and the diversity of interests represented at local level.